another episode of Double Shelix. This is Kayla.
And I'm Sally.
And we are very excited to talk with you all today about science policy for graduate students. And this is our first time in hosting a panel of experts, graduate students, Stephanie, Kathy, and Andrew. And we are very excited to have them all today. So let's start with some introductions.
My name is Andrew Bremer. I am a graduate student in the same program as you two. I work in a tissue engineering lab. So I did my undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is where I'm from. I was born and raised in Madison. And there is a very strong and historic culture of public outreach and public service, especially within academia. And I think that kind of informed my progress through not only undergraduate, but after graduating from there, I chose to participate in the Teach for America program. And so I taught high school science for a couple of years before deciding to come back to research and science to get a graduate degree. And ultimately, I think that background led me to science policy and to Kathy and Stephanie and our current work that we're doing here at Berkeley.
So I'm Stephanie Mack. I am a sixth-year PhD student in the physics department here. And originally, I was actually born in Omaha, Nebraska. Parents are Canadian, so we moved back to Canada when I was pretty young. So that's where I actually did my undergraduate degree, was at the University of Ottawa. And then I moved here for graduate school in 2013 and have been here since then. I only got interested in science policy really when this group was being talked about being formed. And so there was the first interest meeting, and I thought this sounded like something I should know about. At the interest meeting, realized, yes, this is definitely something I should know about. And so that's why I was motivated to help start the group and organize the seminars for the first year. And so this is something that I've been learning about since I'm very focused on continuing academia. But I think it's really important for academics to be aware of how science policy influences academia and vice versa.
Cool. And then the group would be then the Berkeley Science Policy Group, which is now a branch of the
National Science Policy Network.
Cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
So we're a member group of this national group.
I'm Kathy Shields. I am a third year PhD student in the Nuclear Engineering Department. And my research is really in fundamental chemistry that's relevant to nuclear waste and radiotherapeutics. Which is really cool. I like having something that's like really broadly applicable.
And something that's like good, helping people, and something that's bad, nuclear waste.
I'm not going to say that nuclear waste is bad.
Sorry.
I think that's like, it's a really interesting question about like, it is, I guess you could say, the worst part of nuclear energy, but there are a lot of parts of nuclear energy that are a lot more beneficial than
right.
The current energies that we have. So that's a policy-related discussion, for sure. But actually sort of how I got into nuclear engineering through policy, not kind of the other way around. So I did my undergrad at Tufts University outside of Boston, and I double majored in physics and political science. And the whole time that I was there, people were like, how are those going to relate to each other? I was like, I don't know. I'll figure it out eventually. And eventually there was like, I was in a class talking about the Cold War, and there was like a comment about the science of nuclear weapons. And I was like, well, obviously hiding under tables not going to save you from a nuclear weapon. And the other people in my class were like, wait, what? And I was like, guys, that's not how physics works. And I realized that there was like this whole world of people who were going into policy that had zero understanding of how the science and the research like impacts that. So when I came here to Cal to do my PhD, the first thing that I looked for was a group that dealt with the intersection of science and policy, and it didn't exist. And so I was like, okay, we need to create this group because this is a really important skill set for scientists to know about policy and how they can impact policy, but then also to start informing public policy students, political science students about the same thing, because really we need people on both sides of the story that are interested in communicating with each other.
Cool. So how did this group start and what is it?
So conveniently enough, as Kathy was undergoing that thought process of there should be this group, Mark Chulgin and I were elected to the BEAST co-president position. So the Bioengineering Association of Students, the student organization that is within our program, the bioengineering program. And one of our main initiatives that we wanted to start in by the student organization was advocacy, communication, and outreach, which I had been thinking a lot about as kind of what I had said before of just like instilling this public service and public outreach mission within academics. I wanted to introduce that and kind of spread it to the wider program. And a faculty member within bioengineering, Dr. Amy Herr, had not only interacted with Mark and I as we were having this conversation, but had connected with Kathy through, I think, Women Engineers or Society of Women Engineers, maybe?
Or maybe the Government Relations Office? I honestly don't know.
Yeah. So just serendipitously then, Amy was just like, hey, you all should meet. And we did. And I think it was two floors below the room that we're sitting in now, which is where the Science Policy Group at Berkeley became a thing. So that's how we met. And yeah, and Stephanie,
I randomly showed up to that meeting.
Showing up is important. And it's like so underrated. Like if you hold a meeting and you invite graduate students, the average number that will attend is like 2.
Yes.
So
I think we had 7 at that meeting, which was, so there's a really cool conference that the AAAS hosts in DC. It's called CASE, which stands for Catalyzing Advocacy in Science and Engineering. And so they host this conference every year in the spring in DC, and it's basically like a 3-day conference for grad students mostly to like learn about how the federal government works, how the budgeting process works, how do you communicate your science to congressmen, and then they work with your university's government relations team to help you have a day of visits on Capitol Hill. And so I had done this program and I came back from that program and Amy was like, you should give a presentation and let's see if there's a critical mass of people who are interested in standing up a group like this. That's the meeting that Stephanie came to. And here we are.
Yeah. That meeting, I think, had 3-4 students at it. And that was about a year and a half, 18 months ago, maybe. And we're now, our listserv has about 200 on it. So in a pretty short period of time, we've expanded a bit. And as to Kathy's point, there was a critical mass of interest for students to learn more about the intersection of science policy and what that means and how to contribute to it within whatever career choice you pursue after graduating.
Or like if there's other students out there who like are interested in policy, like how can they start their own group or like get involved with groups like campus and like what? Also, the group has 2 purposes, right? Like one is to like do science advocacy and like communicate with Congress and like communicate. And the other is to like train students in these skills. So how do you think about those 2 things in the context of your group and other similar groups?
Yeah. So the way that our group is set up right now, I think we have kind of 3 big goals. So one is kind of educating scientists about how policy works, you know, extending that discussion of what happens at the CASE workshop. And so learning about how science influences policy and policy influences science. So just kind of raising awareness. And then also improving scientists' ability to communicate with policymakers, because that is a very different skill set compared to how we're trained to communicate as scientists in general. So that's another part of what we try to do. And then also developing this network with policymakers at the local level, state level, national level, and developing those relationships and kind of that career development aspect for if people do want to continue in this realm in their future careers. And so our group meets 2x a month. So we usually try to alternate between having an invited speaker who is either a scientist who has gotten involved in policy somewhere along the lines, or someone like people from the government relations team on campus who come and talk about their perspective on it. And then the other meetings are where we try to organize these bigger initiatives like this advocacy outreach, planning trips to Sacramento, planning other things that we want to do. Like this semester, we've been trying to push having people in our group write a lot of op-eds in the Daily Cal or other papers about some issue in science policy that's interesting to them. So that's kind of how we alternate our meetings.
Cool. Speaking of, you guys are organizing a trip to Sacramento and then you went to DC. I also went to DC with the group from UCSF. So when it comes to like face-to-face interaction with policymakers, like what is your sort of thoughts on this in terms of its effectiveness? Because I mean, it's really fun as a student to like feel like I'm here, I'm in the Capitol, like I'm meeting with people, like, wow, fun. But like, what is your thoughts on like the effectiveness of that, or like tips for how to do it well, tips for what we should be doing when we're not meeting with them so that when we are meeting with them, it does go well, such other thoughts.
I think that sometimes you can have meetings, and from your perspective, it's like, okay, they got the information I wanted to tell them, and, you know, there was a conversation there. But I think that policy can, in the same way that basic science research is, you know, it's kind of a longer-term goal in some cases. And so you can have these meetings, and you don't know necessarily who they then talk to, if they talk to anybody. And so on a certain level, sometimes you just can't know. And you just kind of have to hope that, you know, someone's getting this information and maybe it's having an influence.
What you just said kind of points to the importance of ongoing relationships. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think there's a very big difference between the student that goes to their state capital or Washington, D.C., like for a one-off day or a one-off meeting. That's very different than trying to develop a relationship with a legislator. But I will say that, like, more likely than not, the program that you went with to go out to D.C. is something that happens annually,
right,
or semi-annually. And so to that extent, they're bringing a different set of students each time. The case workshop sends a different set of students each time to the Hill. But because it's a recurring event, there is some aspect of every year there's a set of graduate students that go and talk to senators and congresspeople about the importance of funding science and how that funding works and how it supports our livelihoods, but also how it informs basic research, like what Stephanie's doing, or applied research. Like, it's not just a one-time conversation. And I think it's important as a student to remember that you don't have to be the person who's bringing the conversation every time. Even if you're the person who's bringing the conversation just once, like, that's a really valuable experience for you, and it's really useful for the politicians. At the same time, if you're interested in building those relationships, that can be also really valuable. So I'm in the process of organizing our second, like, group trip to Sacramento. And we're going to be going to some of the same offices that we went to 3 months ago.
Cool.
And so I'm starting to develop a relationship with the legislative directors of some of those offices. And as you start to build that relationship and show your value to them as an individual or as a group, they become more and more receptive to, like, hearing what you have to say. So the first time that we went and visited our local senator's office up in Sacramento, they were like, whatever, we don't know who you are, we don't know why you're here, but nice to meet you, your constituents, so we feel obligated to, like, shake your hand. Which does happen. We've definitely had meetings where it's like, okay, great, you're a constituent, I'm going to smile, but I don't know why I'm talking to you. But then this time, like, I sent those same people an email, and I was like, hey, we're coming back to Sacramento. We're really interested in coming and hearing about the legislation that you intend to be introducing and how we can help. How can we do some of the research, read through some of the academic literature, provide, you know, experts in the field that can give you insight on the legislation that you want to introduce to make sure that that legislation is actually going to do what you want it to do. And so the first time it was just us being like, hi, we're here, we exist. The second visit is, hi, we want to know what you need so that we can provide it to you. And as we do that successfully, we're going to start to build a relationship that should outlast that legislative director in that office or me as the person who's organizing those trips and become a relationship between our group and that office.
Cool.
I think it's also worth mentioning that, you know, when you go to these visits, it is the office of an elected representative, but often you're meeting with their staffers. And that it's actually really important to have those relationships with the staffers because they're the ones who are really behind the scenes getting things done.
Right.
And so I know that some people kind of saw it as almost an insult where, oh, the actual representative isn't coming to meet with me. You know, they don't think I'm important enough, blah, 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 blah. But really, I mean, it's kind of almost potentially more effective to meet with the staffer. And then if that staffer stays in that office, that's great because then you have that relationship with them. But then if they move on to some other office or end up in some committee that ends up being more relevant to you, then that also carries forward.
Right.
And so then you kind of expand your reach.
The wild thing for me when I went to DC with UCSF was that it was mostly meeting with staffers. And sometimes you would meet with, like, a more senior staffer who had clearly been a staffer for, like, years and years and was, like, the top person in the office. But, like, most of Congress is run by, like, 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
It's wild, you guys.
It's
wild.
It's nuts. It's, like, and it's not just, like, 21-year-olds. It's, like, unpaid interns. that are like chilling in the office, those are the people that you like end up meeting with a lot of the times. And that's the other thing is like, as PhD students, we have more expertise in like our, whatever our field is, than they could ever hope to have at like 21, right? Like we didn't have the knowledge that we have right now when we were 21. And so I think that's another really valuable thing to remember as a student visiting is like, one, you're going to meet with a staffer who's your age, give or take 5 years, right? And two, like, yeah, they have expertise in how Congress works, but you have the expertise in your science or the, you know, whatever government organization gives you your funding or whatever it is. Like, you have the expertise that is going to inform and help them with what they need.
Also, they have to be knowledgeable about so many topics. So if you can condense what you're trying to say into some kind of, you know, bite-sized nugget, like really a true elevator pitch that's memorable for them, then that makes their job easier too.
And back to your original question as well, to that point, I think preparation for those meetings is important regardless of how...
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
how do you prepare?
Like,
very carefully.
So to Stephanie's point, it's like what isn't effective when going into those meetings is bringing all of your data and like presenting them all of this information about how you formed your hypothesis and how there's nuances within your data and how you had to analyze it in various ways to come to your conclusion. They've already fallen asleep or thinking about something else and texting somebody else because they have 8 more meetings that day. Communicating like no more than 3 basic points and really sharing the story is what's effective, most effective, because that's going to be memorable, right?
You give us a pitch example? You're like, hi, I'm Sally. I'm a staffer for the Wolf office. Hello? Hi?
So an example from my research, we were at this case conference back in March. We learned about the funding process of science, federal funding of science. And one of our main goals is to communicate research outcomes and research potential that this money was going towards, whether it's the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, whatever route of funding it was. So I talked about adult neural stem cells, which is what I work on, their implications in learning and memory. They're found within a region called the hippocampus. So our goal is to understand these cells more so that we might be able to use them for therapeutic applications for patients in Alzheimer's disease, for example. That is one way of really just breaking down what you're studying and why.
Other takes? Yeah.
I had it really polished at the time. But I mean, so I would basically go and say, hi, my name is Stephanie. I'm a graduate student funded by the Department of Energy, and I'm working on using the latest and greatest computational and theoretical techniques to understand and predict material properties for different energy applications. And then based on what they're interested in, maybe they want to hear more about, oh, you're funded by the Department of Energy. You know, what specific grant or what kind of initiative is that part of? Or they might pick up on, oh, computational, so, you know, what does that mean? And then I might bring up the fact that, you know, the National Lab has these amazing supercomputing facilities and how those are some of the best in the world, and that's kind of very exciting. Or they might say, okay, for energy applications, so, you know, what are we talking about? Solar mm-hmm. devices, you know? So depending on their particular interest, you kind of want to give them that one sentence and then see what they pick up on, and then you can expand into whatever they want.
Definitely knowing who the person is and kind of what their understanding or background is and interests are important. So an example to that is when we met with the representative from Barbara Lee's office, who's our representative within the House of Representatives. She is within the HIV caucus. So they focus on HIV research, HIV outreach, preventative medicine, and awareness. So talking about what are the research outcomes that have happened over the last 20, 30, 40 years, and what kind of basic science had to happen 50, 60 years ago from Drs. David Baltimore and Howard Tennant, like random scientists from the 50s, 60s, whose research has ultimately influenced now how we can treat HIV patients who have life expectancies that are almost normal, right? That's just like a fascinating story of science that I think resonates specifically with her because she understands the importance of this as somebody who participates within this caucus within that.
And I guess thinking back when I was in D.C., one of the offices that we met with was, I don't remember his name, but he was like the representative from the part of Florida where they have like Cape Canaveral and all the NASA stuff. And so like a lot of his constituents are like big into space. So, I mean, my research is sort of not relevant to space. I mean, everything is relevant to space because when we all colonize space, whatever, whatever. But
start mining.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so people were talking about like how their research helps NASA. And most people could come up with something.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to figure out with whomever you're about to meet, how does your research relate to something that matters to them? And then the other thing, we haven't talked about one-pagers yet, but also known as leave-behinds, but this is to your question about how do you prepare for a meeting. So there, it's definitely important to prepare, like, your pitch, to know, it's really important to have a goal. Is your goal to go in and advocate for more federal funding? Is your goal to go in and advocate for a specific type or piece of legislation to be, you know, implemented in California, whatever. But whatever your goal is, you want to have a one-page, like a PDF or a piece of paper that you can leave behind in the office. And different offices will do different things with that. But generally, they'll end up, if it's an interesting issue or an issue that whatever representative you're meeting with cares about, it'll end up in their actual hands. And so this is something that you want to have your bottom line up front. You want to have your goal, your request, whatever it is, like really clearly specified on that page. We learned last time we were in Sacramento that generally you want it to be, like, it doesn't need to be black and white if you're handing it to them, but if you're emailing it to them either before or afterwards, they usually print it out in black and white. And so knowing that and making sure that like whatever colors you're using contrast well if they're printed in black and white is like just a small little piece of information. One of the staffers was telling me that whenever they get climate related things with like lots of like line graphs with lots of different things or bar graphs or something, she has to print it out and then pull it up on her computer and pull out like her set of Sharpies or highlighters and like highlight the different sections so that she can make sure that it's clear enough when she gives it to the actual representative, which like just make her job easier, right?
Just like spend 20 cents on color ink and like,
But just make like when you're actually making your PDF that you're sending, like if you're doing it in Adobe, there's a really nice little setting that you can go to that's like show in black and white and also show for colorblind people. Super useful. But just like that's just a little thing. Make sure that it works for them because that's going to make you more valuable to their office and they're more likely to listen to you that time and the next time, which is always good.
But yes, this kind of inside secret is why we bring experts on the podcast like yourself.
Exactly. So what are some examples of the kinds of things that you advocate for? Do you, during your meetings, do you decide what you're going to do or do you individually have different strategies?
I think it depends on the specific group that's going and maybe who you're talking to. You definitely decide that before, right? There's a variety of topics that are being worked on for this upcoming trip to Sacramento. And it extends far beyond funding, right? A great example would be H-1B visas, right? Which is an example of policy for science. So H-1B visas are for international
experts.
The general description of it is when you bring a unique skill set or knowledge to the country. And so a lot of students and researchers come into the U.S. using these visas. And so if it's more difficult for them to acquire those visas, then it's harder for people to travel to the U.S. in order to do amazing scientific research. And so, I mean, science is such an international society, and, you know, there's been all sorts of studies showing that, you know, really impactful science does come from more collaboration and more diversity. And so if we're making that harder for people to be able to do that, then this is something that's directly impacting our scientific output.
Another example of something that we're we have a group of students who will be advocating for this in Sacramento in a few weeks, is a science advisor to the governor of the state of California. So currently there is no like scientific expert who has the governor's ear, essentially. So that would be at the federal level. There's the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is headed by the science advisor to the president, or I don't know his title. But we don't have something like that in the state of California. And this, so one of the things that students will be advocating for is creating this position, having it staffed by a PhD scientist who basically can say, you know what, we need to be incorporating more research into this particular area, or there's a lot of really valuable research that we could leverage to change this, that, or the other thing. So we can really advocate for kind of anything that we want. We are careful as a member group of the National Science Policy Network that we are a nonpartisan group. So we're very adamant that science is a nonpartisan field. Like, the scientists aren't saying or doing research in the direction of a specific policy per se. And as a group, we're also kind of along those lines that we think science should be included in the science, in the policy process, but that's not necessarily that a specific policy should be enacted, if that makes sense. It's kind of a narrow line.
It can get very confusing.
Yeah.
But
so the way that I like to phrase it is science can be political, but it doesn't have to be partisan.
Mm-hmm. That should be like a tagline on a website.
And actually, kind of on the note of science advisors, so in Canada, they recently brought in...
So good at this.
Well, we only recently actually had a scientific advisor position implemented at the federal level. And so she's actually been in her position for just over a year, I believe, now. And so this used to be a position that Canada had a while ago, and then it went away at some point during the Harper administration. And then when Trudeau became prime minister, it's something, one of the things that he brought back was this position. And so she's actually been, kind of paving a new path forward for this kind of scientific advisor position, and has been really pushing for more of these kind of positions in different federal agencies throughout the Canadian government. So that's been something really interesting to see happen, and is a very relevant science policy in the news kind of topic.
So this leads nicely into a discussion that we were hoping to have about communicating your science. So how can the average graduate student be involved in science policy? There's groups like this, but even just what are ways to be knowledgeable about this process at a very low basal level?
Do we want to start all the way back to voting? That is one way to participate
yeah,
or be involved, being an informed voter, because ultimately you have people who represent you, right, within every level of government. And you as their constituent can not only help decide who is seated in that office, but also kind of what that person is or should be representing and be informed of.
Yeah, so I think it starts with knowing what you're voting for and then actually voting. But then something that is quite easy to do as a graduate student, if there's something that you care about, write a letter don't write a physical letter. Here's another fun tidbit. Don't write physical letters and send them, especially not to DC, because it takes 2 to 3 weeks to go through the mailroom process at Congress. Of, like, they have to check and make sure that, you know, it doesn't have anthrax, it's not a bomb, et cetera, et cetera. So it's nice to think that sending physical letters, handwritten, is, like, a good thing. But if you want to send, like, a Christmas letter, send it in, like, October. It's far better to send emails, and you can always do that through your representative's website. Or if it's a really time-sensitive issue, picking up the phone, using your phone the old-fashioned way, actually dialing a number and talking to somebody on the other side.
And they will always take your calls.
Yes.
Because it's part of the staffer's jobs is to hear from the constituents.
Yeah.
So it seems very scary the first time you do it.
Have you ever called a member of Congress or your California representative on behalf of a science policy issue?
Yeah.
Oh, tell us more.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Does the grad tech count as a science policy issue?
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys may or may not recall last November that there was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which got a lot of press for a lot of different reasons. But one of the reasons that it was really impactful or could have been very impactful on graduate students is that it changed our tax status. And so it could have resulted in graduate students getting taxed on what our, like, PIs pay in our tuition.
I remember this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you're not in graduate school, basically what that means is, like, every month or every year, graduate students make around $30,000, depending on the school, whatever. So let's say you make $30,000, and that's, like, given to you 1/12th per month or 1/10th per month for 10 months, and then you get nothing for two. Anyway. That's given to you, like, you get $30,000 a year, like, you get a payment every month or every 2 weeks or whatever. And then, meanwhile, your PI, so your boss, like, the professor that you work for, he or she gets money from the government that they just give directly to the university. Or, like, it goes, like, it never touches you, and it sometimes won't even touch your boss. Like, the money goes from the government, and it somehow, like, goes to the university.
Well,
to pay your tuition.
I'm going to clarify.
Oh, am I wrong? Yeah.
No, you're completely right. But instead of saying government, I would say, like, grant, like, research grant institution.
Oh,
so
okay.
So most of the time that's the government. For I'm paid by the Department of Energy. So it's Stephanie, you're paid by NIH?
I'm paid by the NIH, yeah, mostly.
Okay.
From graduate school.
But there are also,
like, the American
some
Cancer
labs,
Society.
Exactly. Some labs are going to be paid by,
okay,
Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, whatever. Whatever institution, like, pays for your lab, somewhere around $40,000 of that goes directly to the university. You never see it.
So that's paying for tuition.
Yeah.
Fees.
And those
fees.
Yeah. Those numbers are relevant for Berkeley, right? It changes depending on where the university
yeah.
is as well as what specific university.
And
so
if it's
great
private
exa-
or not.
If you're,
great
going
example,
to a, if you're going to a private school that has a $70,000 a year tuition for graduate students, this would be like someone who earns $30,000 a year paying taxes on a quote-unquote income of 30 plus 70 equals $100,000 a year equals $30,000 a year equals all of your stipend.
Which is a
yes.
big difference.
Which would ultimately would have limited the ability of a lot of students to participate in the research process by becoming graduate students. And so getting back to the original question of have you ever called your legislators on an issue, we as a group actually did a lot of work around the grad tax. One of our members, Vetri, created this really cool like Google Doc calculator that you could figure out how much the change was going to impact you and how much more money or less money you were going to have to pay in taxes. Mm-hmm. And then we sent it out to all of our friends at all of our different universities and it kind of went viral. And one of the things that we did on campus is we organized a phone bank that we had, like, I want to say we had 88 students. I don't know why I remember this number. 88 different students that came in and all of them called, you know, 2, 3, 4 representatives from maybe like Berkeley's reps, but then maybe from their hometown or where their parents live or where they went to undergrad, calling and basically being like, hey, you need to stop this before it starts because this is a terrible idea. We did also have at least a couple of students who came to our phone bank and called and were like, I like this idea. I think this is a good change. It's going to be beneficial for these following reasons, which, again, we were providing phone scripts that were like, this is how we had the people there that they could practice with. We had phone scripts of this is like how you're going to call. This is what they're going to say. This is what you want to say. But
scripts in the sense of, you know, sense. How do you introduce yourself and, you know, how do you be succinct? So not telling people exactly what to say about, because we wanted people to say whatever their actual opinion was. But, you know, kind of lowering that barrier to being able to make these calls and having, you know, laptops up where you could look up who your actual representatives were. And so just trying to make it as easy as possible for people to be able to share their opinion with their elected representatives.
Cool. I know that, like, at least what I learned from when we went to DC or whatever was that, like, they kind of care about you more if you're their constituent than if you're not.
Absolutely.
But I think a lot of graduate students, like, I'm here in Berkeley, like, Barbara Lee supports science. That's our representative, you know. But, like, where I'm from in Nebraska, there's, like, different sort of vibes. But, like, how much would those senators and representatives care about me because I'm, like, a Nebraskan, but I also, like, don't live there, don't elect them.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, what's been your experience with this? Like, Do you just sort of fake it and give your parents' address? Or
so, no, don't do that. But, like, in your case, what you could do is you could call the senators from Nebraska, and you could call up and you can say, I was born and raised in Nebraska.
Got it.
Or you could say, my parents still live in Nebraska, and they're constituents.
Got it.
But you don't want to misrepresent yourself
as
a constituent. I will clarify that constituent does not mean eligible to vote. So children that live in a district are still constituents of a representative. International students that are not U.S. citizens and therefore can't vote, still constituents. So there is a difference between a constituent and a voter. But generally, when you're calling reps, they will ask you, are you a constituent? Like, do you live in the member's district? Mm-hmm. And especially on, like, big issues that are in the news a lot, and, like, the grad talks was getting a lot of phone calls into Congress, they essentially have a tally sheet going that's, like, constituent, not constituent, support, oppose.
Hmm.
And so whatever you say gets, broken down into, like, a tally mark in one of those four categories.
Hmm.
And then at the end of the day, that tally will get handed to the representative, and it'll be like, look, you got 167 phone calls today, 42 of them were from constituents that supported, 54 of them were from constituents that opposed, the remainder were from non-constituents, and it broke down this way.
Hmm.
And so that's kind of why we, like, provide phone scripts. Like, if you're calling on something that's a really hot topic at the moment, you don't want to go off on, like, a 45-minute-long rant, because they will just, like, ignore you and sit at their computer doing other things and be like, uh-huh, yes, ma'am, I'm still listening. But if you want to, like, summarize what you're saying in one sentence, I am a constituent in your district, and I oppose the grad tax for this reason.
Got it.
Or just don't say the reason. Just, I oppose grad tax. Thank you for your time. Have a good day.
And what happened to the grad tax?
It was not included in the final language. Nothing is changed, and we don't have to pay taxes on our tuition.
Cool.
Yay.
Yeah, and,
the crowd
and,
goes wild.
And to the note of Kathy and Becky's work on that, it ultimately didn't become part of the final legislation because it was recognized in a bipartisan way as being not only a huge financial disincentive for people going to get more training within a graduate program, but also the recognition that it created additional financial barriers for a lot of people to actually go pursue a graduate degree. And I think there is general bipartisan agreement that there should be some level of equity inclusion within graduate studies, and that specific legislation would have severely impacted a number of students.
I will also say that the work that we did last year on that would have not been possible without the university government relations team. So I'm going to just take this moment to make a quick plug to any students who are interested in creating groups or at universities that don't have groups. A really great resource is your university government or community relations. They all have different office names, but these are people that their entire job is to represent the university to policymakers. And it's usually like the university as a whole. But in our experience, they were absolutely ecstatic to find out that there were science students who were interested in doing this. It's something that, like, science policy specifically hadn't been necessarily really big on their radar. But as we introduced ourselves and some of our goals, they were so supportive, and they've been so useful in making connections to offices. They were on in Washington, D.C. during the grad talks, like, flying back and forth. The amount of time they spent on planes is insane. But, like, they were really instrumental in – they have those relationships that I was talking about earlier. And they're willing to share those relationships with us, which has been a big way that we have been able to get in contact. So – if you're interested, if you're like a group that's looking to do more advocacy at state houses or at DC, working with your government relations office is going to be crucial to doing that. But also, if you're an individual student or professor or postdoc.
Yes, professors. Your future depends on your speaking up for funding, not just in your grants, but also in your life.
Yeah. But I mean, even if you're an individual at a university that doesn't have a group and you're not interested in creating a group, but you are interested in science policy, the government relations team is going to be a really good resource for helping you. If you are like, hey, I want to go to the state house, will you help me set up a day's worth of meetings to advocate for the importance of continued state funding for our university or whatever it might be? So
they're also just full of ideas about things you can do as well, and have just such an incredible network of people that they know. So they've really helped us get some really cool speakers for our group to come talk to us. And then when Andrew and I went to DC for this case workshop earlier this year, and I think also when you went, the third day of this workshop is meant to be a day on the Hill where you get to have meetings with staffers. And it was really the UC government relations team that basically came to us, said, okay, what's your wish list of people you want to meet with? Like, whose offices are you interested in? And set up an entire day of meetings for us and shepherded us between all of these offices, because the whole thing's a maze. And so that's been an incredible resource. And also, I'd say, if you're also affiliated with a national lab, they also have government relations teams, and they are also an amazing resource to have. And a lot of people who go through this AAAS Science Policy Fellowship, which is kind of what I interpret as being like a postdoc if you're interested in science policy.
it really is.
Yeah. Quite a few of them actually end up in kind of these DOE national lab settings, and they also have an incredible network of people that they know and are so enthusiastic if you express any interest in this whatsoever. So there's a lot of people out there who want people to be interested, but you know, you really have to step in up and say, yeah, this is something I'm interested in.
Yeah.
They're also really useful for like fun tidbits, like don't make your color things, make sure that they print in black and white. Like a really useful piece of information I got from one of them. I went to DC like on my own. They taught me how to contact reps and contact legislative aides and directors and like set up my own day of meetings after they'd helped me set up a day of meetings. But I was going over what I was going to talk with them, like talk about with the government relations team. And one of them was like, you're not allowed to talk about that because that's about being elected. And they're not allowed to discuss election related things in their DC offices because you can't. That's like, I don't know, for a whole
campaign.
Yeah,
something.
It's campaign something something.
Yeah,
they're not.
So rules.
So there's just like really useful pieces of information where they're like, you can talk about that, but they can't talk back. So if you want to have an actual conversation, maybe avoid that topic.
Another tip that I got from the UCSF government relations people, UCSF has some that are just they're based in DC, and the reason that they're so well networked is because like when they were 21, like they were staffers. And so now they're not, and they are hard. Like anyway.
I was just going to say, even for me, just even practically speaking, like how you walk into an office kind of, that professional mannerisms you need to adopt, which, you know, as you're a science graduate student, you don't necessarily on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, we're sitting here in sports gear, a
sorry,
and I'm wearing floral leggings. Like, this is not DC.
Right, so, you know, checking in on, you know, how you should present yourself. Mm-hmm. And even when you go in the office, you know, being prepared to have a meeting standing in the hallway versus in a tiny cubicle versus in a huge conference room, just being prepared for all those settings. And also, just even having your business cards and knowing how to do the business card exchange was kind of something that they had warned me about and I had never even considered. And then when we got there and, you know, you sit down at the table and everyone just kind of puts their business card on the table and there's kind of this swapping that happens as you're doing the introductions. Like, if I wasn't prepared for that, I would have been like, this is the
weirdest
thing.
That's a thing.
Yeah, and the staffer will sit with their notebook in front of them and, you know, you pass them their business card and you can see them subtly writing your name in the order in which you're sitting in front of them. So that way when they're in the meeting, they're able to address you by name, which is, so you think they're able to remember all of this, but it's all these tricks that
they like draw a map of the table and they're like,
yeah,
Andrew.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But I mean, it's just that level of professionalism that I think, you know, we're not trained as STEM graduate students to really have necessarily. And I think if you can go into those offices and have that, then it also, you know, increases the likelihood that they'll listen to you a bit more.
I mean, it's also like silly things. Like I have a water bottle. I carry it around like everywhere that I go and it's covered in stickers, and I have multiple water bottles with multiple different like sets of stickers. And, one of the government relations people, the first time I was in D.C., she was like, okay, turn your water bottle so that sticker is facing the aide, because I know that they're interested in hiking, and there's, like, a hiking sticker on my water bottle. And so I've made, like, it made, like, a really easy, like, it, like, way to, like, introduce each other, but then it also kind of let me, like, we were talking about hiking, we were talking about the outdoors, we were talking about the importance of clean air, and then I could be like, oh, you know what, nuclear energy is a lot better in terms of air pollution than coal, and, like, we could spin our conversation into, like, what I actually wanted to talk about, which was, you know, and then, so it's just these, like, little things. She also got mad at me because it was a red water bottle, not a blue or gold water bottle, and I was, like, not wearing Cal colors.
I'm Berkeley.
She was like, I'm buying you a Cal water bottle for next time.
Yeah, they actually told us the night before all of our meetings to try to basically internet stalk who we were meeting with to try to find these kind of connections. So, you know, like, we didn't know we were both from Omaha.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I properly prepared for this meeting.
Likewise.
I would have known. And then you throw it in. And it's that way of, you know, building relationship. Like, you want to be able to, you know them as a person as well as just in a purely.
And I think for students, like, when I think of this sort of online preparation that you would do for this kind of meeting, like, in my mind, it seems 100% absolutely creepy and stalkerish. And, like, when you do it before a date, it's weird. But I think it's important to realize that, like, in a professional setting, it's expected.
And it's, like, you wouldn't blink twice before researching a potential postdoc that, like, if your advisor was like, hey, we're having 3 postdoc interviews for the new postdoc position, like, hey, will you come and sit in their offices? You would not think twice about Googling them and looking at the papers that they've already published and, like, where they're coming from. Like, you wouldn't, that, you know, that wouldn't even consider, you wouldn't even consider that, like, weird. It's just expected. And it's kind of the same thing. You could think of this as, like, your pre-postdoc kind of research.
Yeah.
So on this note of, you mentioned the AAAS scholarship?
Yeah, the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Why do you remember that?
I've crushed it.
I would say most scientists or academics probably know them for publishing the journal Science.
Mm-hmm.
They're the group that
publishes
science.
We've mentioned it in passing. They also have a very cool postdoc, quote-unquote, for after you've gotten your PhD to go and work for a year or 2 years in DC. And that could be the Congressional Fellowship, which is on the Hill in different offices. But it's also, there are also, executive branch offices. So you can go and you can do a year long posting in NIH or NSF or DOE or the White House Office of Science Technology Policy. I don't know where they all are, but they're really cool opportunities for people who are interested in maybe exploring whether or not this is something that they're interested in doing, but they're also, like, towards the end of their PhD.
So for a graduate student who's interested in being involved in science policy beyond graduate school, perhaps more as a career, and what are the options and how can they go into that?
As we mentioned, for some of these fellowships, they're a great way to start, whether it's the AAAS one, but a number of others. The California Council of Science and Technology, which is a state-based fellowship here in California. The Mir Zion Fellowship. There's a number of fellowships that place either late-stage graduate students or recent
graduates
within various levels of government to get experience working within within the policy sphere.
And those are especially great because you apply and they know that you have a science background. So a part of it is, you know, kind of, they know that they need to give you a crash course into how policy works. And you're not necessarily coming with a lot of experience in that way. So that's really built into some of these programs, which I think is especially advantageous for someone who's thinking about switching to a more policy-related job.
And then beyond the government fellowships, there's a number of professional societies that also have advocacy arms that hire on and bring on trained STEM professionals with advanced degrees to work in various policy jobs as advocates.
So let's say I graduate, I get this prestigious fellowship in the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and I work there, and I'm, like, in a congressperson's office, and I'm, like, doing their science stuff, and they're, like, here's a science question, and I'm, like, I don't know anything about the climate, but, like, I'm going to answer it for you because I'm trained as a PhD, and I can answer questions and, like, research them quickly and get them back to you. And then after 2 years, that's over, So then what job do I do? And also, when I have this policy job, what am I doing?
So, I mean, we've had quite a few meetings where we bring in alumni of these different programs. And kind of the one thing that they've all emphasized is that there is no typical day in policy. And so one day you could be doing a ton of research onto some climate change issue and trying to create a one-pager about this topic to bring to whoever you're working for.
In 12 hours.
Yeah. Another day you could be taking constituent phone calls if you're, and you know, trying to do that stuff. And then, I mean, there's, and then another day you could be meeting with a committee and trying to understand what's happening there and contributing there. And so there is no typical day, and it seems you just kind of have to be willing to jump into it and be ready to do anything. And then in terms of what happens after, quite a few of them, or I guess they say a third tend to go back to academia in some kind of role. A third do continue in similar offices to where they actually did the fellowship. So, you know, or at least similar offices where, you know, you've developed this network over the past year or two. And so you kind of get an idea, okay, maybe I don't want to keep working at the congressional level, but, you know, a state agency might be really interesting. And so you can switch around and you have that network now of all the other fellows and all of their offices to kind of figure out what you want to do. So I think that it's hard to say exactly what you do every single day, but I don't know. The one thing they've emphasized is just the network you develop is the best resource out of these fellowships.
Also, so you said a third stay in academia, a third stay in policy, and I think the last third kind of go into industry.
Right.
Whether that's working for, like, for you guys, working for some biomedical company in their government or advocacy arm, or, you know, it could be anything. And, yeah.
Or back to research. I mean, almost people who go back to academia, people who go to industry and work still within research, but now have that added expertise of kind of understanding how policy works and how they can contribute from the industry side to.
Yeah, and I think there's like, there's this narrative that once you finish your PhD and you leave academia for whatever, like there's no returning, which I think is increasingly false. And so I think
it could depend on what role in academia you want to return to, though.
Yeah, but if you're doing like a, if we think of the AAAS as a policy postdoc, you can come back and do a technical postdoc and then continue on your professor trajectory.
And they have mentioned that there are assistant professors who do this fellowship and then will return back to their post.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, I guess I would just say that doing a science policy fellowship or a science policy job after you graduate does not equal leaving academia and leaving research forever, which I know for a lot of people is like, oh, this is something that I'm interested in learning more about, but I can't do it because it's going, like, I can't do it full time because it's going to mean that I then can't come back to the job that I really want. And I think that that's a narrative that's false and like kind of old fashioned.
Specific examples, maybe, to your question, Sally, about what are you actually doing?
Yeah, like in your long term,
like stuff. You mean like during? Yeah, the fellowship?
No, like after the like you do the fellowship, you're like, I'm the third that's staying in policy. You stay in policy, and like 10 what years later, like what's your job?
So I think
like what do you do? Yeah. Like
I had a phone call with someone who's working for USAID doing energy development programming in Malaysia. He has a super cool job. I would love to do that. There's an example.
You could be working within the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, working to develop some big kind of top-down science
like the initiative. Cancer moonshot.
Like yes, the cancer moonshot.
Exactly. Or the
like
real moonshot. The original moonshot.
Yeah. Like the human genome initiative or the brain initiative. There's so many examples where there are trained STEM professionals who are still working in policy, helping to kind of create these big missions and trying to like gather the group of people and understand how we can make it happen.
And we had a speaker that came into our group and talked about this a little bit. And one of the things that he was talking about is how like it's 4 or 5 years between when like the White House OSTP or some other office first kind of proposes an idea before it actually gets into the language of granting institutions that go out to PIs. And then we know that it's another 2 years between when the PI submits the grant and actually gets the money and starts doing the research. And so you're looking at like 7-ish years between when somebody working in the policy world is like, you know what, we should consider looking into how this is going to impact the world 10 years from now. Like, it's 7 years before you even get to funding graduate students to actually start doing the research. So like, if you want to, you know, create the seeds of change for like the entire scientific industry, you know, maybe you should do that for the policy world.
And you can also be in organizations like the Department of Energy or NIH or things like that and really helping decide also their research goals and directives and helping decide, you know, how the budget that they're allocated gets set to different programs. So kind of a more program manager role. And so, I mean, those are also incredibly influential because you really are deciding future research directions that, you know, people will pursue over the next how many years. So, yeah, it's pretty broad what is possible, and it's a little daunting in some respects, I find.
But it's also really exciting.
Yeah.
Because there's so many awesome examples of how, as we said before, like the intersection of science and policy, how science operates and how policy informs it. NASA is the perfect example of that. And as Sally said, the real moonshot.
The original.
The original moonshot. Think about the process, right? Where it's like, JFK, when he talked at Rice University, we choose to go to the moon, and not because they are easy, but because they are hot. Yeah, no, well, this is my really bad JFK impression.
That was terrible.
But think about what that kind of like policy for science eventually led to, and eventually
right.
then the science for policy. But
I mean, hasn't NASA developed infrared thermometers?
Yeah, exactly. All of this technology that has come out of this really broad level science initiative that is coming from the highest level of the American government, right? So it's really cool to think, so NASA is one example and what that has led to in terms of satellite communication and GPS technologies to, yeah,
smartphones
yeah. And now like the human genome project, right? Where
we know all the genes, so we've cured all the diseases now.
To that point though, where it's like, we understand now so much more about the human genome
right.
than we did when Ronald Reagan... when his administration kind of were thinking about what to do, and until George W. H.W. Bush, kind of his administration was one that kind of initially
right.
funded it. But now relevant to my research is the Brain Initiative that came out of the Obama administration to really think about the brain is just not understood. We know a lot about it, but what is consciousness even, and how does that work, and how do the specific cells communicate with one another? And it's really exciting to think about what is the potential for...
And there's an analogous initiative for materials where,
exactly.
you know, we want to
yeah.
be able to study and be able to have information on all of the materials that are known and could be synthesized. And so I think that's why it's so important to have people who have experience in basic science research in these kind of positions, because they have seen in their own experience that, you know, having these huge initiatives that, you know, maybe we won't achieve the huge goal that we set out, but the progress made in research towards that will inevitably lead to really interesting results.
You guys, this is so inspiring.
I feel
it's
so inspired
yeah.
too.
Science and it's at every level, right? It's the policymakers and the people working within these offices who are thinking about these grand ideas all the way down to the graduate student who is receiving a graduate research fellowship for their graduate studies that's actually working on a project that is embedded within this larger goal.
Yeah.
So when we say the intersection of science and policy, really, I think every single scientist can make a connection in some level to how their work is connected to the policy world.
And I think that's why it's important for scientists to also remember that as much as, you know, our own research is kind of a long-term vision and you have to count the minor victories on the route to that, policy is kind of the same way, where... You know, you could start something, and this gets back to one of your first questions about how do you know if this meeting you had is effective or not? I mean, you don't really, but the same way in science, you don't know when you're testing
right.
something that'll work.
Yeah.
You just kind of keep going.
And like, if you have these executive level sort of scientific initiatives, it could be described as like always working for a professor that you know is not going to get tenure. Because, like, in 4 or 8 years, they're gone. And, like, the new person might also think their brains are cool, but they might be like, actually, no, we're into bones. Sorry.
Yeah. So then depending how that policy is written out, I mean, the individual DOE or NIH could, you know, actually have it embedded in their budget where they can actually continue it, even if our professor doesn't get tenure and doesn't want to do it anymore.
Oh my gosh, this has been amazing. You guys are amazing. I hate to say goodbye, but it's only for fake because we're going to keep going and release it later. We're going to talk more about how funding works and like this research that is done. Like, what is that money? Where is it from? So stay tuned for that in our next episode.